Welcome, everyone, to the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and this is episode 75, Pareto Satisficing for Overwhelmed Educators. Our essential question in this episode is, how can we help teachers eliminate stressful time wasters and spend more of their time on high-impact work? And we're also going to examine that question from the perspective of our own work as instructional leaders. There is an epidemic of overwork going on right now in our profession. Teachers are being pulled in multiple directions by the demands of perhaps face-to-face instruction, virtual instruction, planning for learners in a variety of contexts, and just so much is new that I think we've got to really be smart about how we approach the workload issue, because if we're not careful, we are going to see burnout. We are going to see people just hitting the wall in terms of what they're able to keep up with, because we're definitely seeing some unsustainable workloads right now. So the idea of Pareto satisficing, I was going to call this Pareto optimizing, but I realized we're actually talking about a different concept. It comes from two distinct concepts in the world of administrative studies, and this is research that goes back centuries, but we're going to refer to some research by Herbert Simon and also the well-known Pareto principle today. This was actually the bulk of my reading in my doctoral program. A lot of the organizations and policy literature comes from the work of Herbert Simon and Herbert Simon's students, and he is the originator of the satisficing concept that we're going to introduce later on. But briefly, satisficing, for our purposes here, means simply that good enough is good enough. It's kind of the opposite of perfectionism. And the Pareto principle, which we're going to talk about first, is what you may also have heard of as the 80-20 rule. So let's jump right in and talk about the Pareto principle and how we can apply that to teacher workload and help teachers do more of what matters and less of what is taking up vast amounts of time without making a difference in learning. The Pareto principle is named after the Italian economist Vilfredo Pareto, and there are many stories about how he came up with this principle. One goes that he was working in his garden and saw that only 20% of the pea plants were responsible for producing 80% of the peas, and the other 80% of the plants only produced 20% of the peas. And I don't know if that's a true story, perhaps a bit of a legend that's developed, but he did become famous for his recognition that when it came to wealth in Italy, he was an economist, he studied things like wealth distribution, he did find that 20% of the families controlled 80% of the wealth, and the other 80% of the population controlled only 20% of the wealth. And this is known today in the business world as the Pareto principle, the idea that 20% of our efforts are responsible for 80% of our results, and vice versa, 80% of our efforts are only responsible for 20% of our results. And, you know, of course, we could attach different numbers to those. This is just a rule of thumb. But the idea is, if we can figure out which 20% of our efforts is producing the 80% of our results, we can eliminate almost everything else and still get largely the same results. And when it comes to remote learning or hybrid learning, we have a lot of options for what we could eliminate, what we could be doing instead, what we can keep doing. You know, we have choices to make that often we made very hastily over the summer. Maybe there were some very quick decisions that were made about new things to add or new things to take on or what to put in the learning management system. And if those are producing very little in the way of results and taking up a great deal of time, they are prime candidates for what's normally called Pareto optimization. And we're actually going to talk about satisficing rather than optimizing today, as you will see in just a moment. But I want to introduce this concept from the business world because I think too often we don't properly value teacher time. And we don't even properly value our own time. We just think, well, this needs to get done, so we're going to put in the time, we're going to put in the effort, and we're not really going to worry about whether that effort was worthwhile. In other words, what we don't do too often in education is a cost-benefit analysis. So as a thought exercise, I'd like to invite you to think about what you are asking teachers to do or what you are allowing teachers to do if they've committed to that themselves and you're not stopping them. What if we analyzed that in terms of cost. What if you actually had to write a check for every single thing that teachers do? What if there was a bill that came due every time teachers graded an assignment or filmed a video to upload to their learning management system or produced some sort of new resource for their students? What if that actually took money out of your school budget, the same way using the copier does, right? If you make 1,000 copies, you know that's going to cost some money. That's going to have to come from somewhere in your budget. But teacher time is just a flat line item, right? You know how much teacher time is going to cost for the year. I don't think there are any schools anywhere that pay teachers by the hour, fortunately. But there are also very few schools that have strict working hours for teachers. And we just let them kind of expand their workload and extend their workday without any limits. And that produces what I really see as an unsustainable workload issue that we've got to deal with at a leadership level. It leads us to this mistaken idea that teacher time is free when we don't have to pay for it directly, right? If teachers got overtime the way, you know, police officers got overtime, we would see just how much work teachers are putting in. And since we know that that's not an actual option, we have to do this as a thought exercise, right? What if you had to actually write a check or spend money out of your school budget for every single thing that teachers do? We would have a direct incentive to optimize and find efficiencies much better. And I would suggest to you that the question we need to be asking ourselves is, will this particular effort, will this particular use of time and energy on the teacher's part have a direct impact on student learning? And of course, this is a great question to ask for ourselves as well. Now, sometimes as administrators, we have to do things that clear the way for teaching and learning, even if they don't seem directly related to teaching and learning. So there's going to be a degree of indirectness to our work. But for teachers, when we're looking to free up teacher time and take things off of teachers' plates, we've got to ask ourselves, is this part of the 20% of the effort that's going to produce 80% of the student learning? How is that supposed to work? Will this produce results for students? And will this close an instructional gap? And if you're not familiar with the term instructional gap, I introduced that in our previous episode, episode 74 of the Instructional Leadership Show, where we talked about the idea of getting students from point A to point B, being an exercise in kind of closing the gap between where students are now and where we want them to be. And we have lots of different language for talking about that. We talk about objectives and standards and learning targets and success criteria. And, you know, we think about it at the unit planning level, at the assessment level. There are lots of ways we talk about this. But in general, I want to frame that for you as an instructional gap, not just a way to fill time, not just a busy work assignment, but something that actually moves students from where they are now to where we want them to be. And if it's not that, why are we doing it? What do we have in place that does not close instructional gaps? If that's part of what's taking up teachers' time on a regular basis and adding to their stress, it's a prime candidate for elimination. I want to briefly share 6 essential elements that can help you figure out if what you are having teachers do is actually closing their instructional gaps and meeting their needs. And this is from Dr. Amy Bader's training, Designing Engaging Virtual Learning. And she says the 6 essential elements of engaging online learning are engagement with content. Obviously, we have to be teaching some specific content. Providing scaffolds so that we're supporting all students, especially students who need that extra support. Providing real-world connections so that there's a why, there's a need to know for the content and a purpose to the work. 4th, active inquiry. So we're actively engaging students. It's not busy work. It's not passive. It's not sit and get. It is active engagement in inquiry. 5th, feedback and assessment. And I would suggest that when it comes to teacher workload, that's a very important place to focus on how we're providing feedback to students if we're doing that in a timely and efficient and useful manner. And of course, there are lots of options, especially in subjects like math, for how we provide that feedback. And then finally, relationships. I think we have to be very careful not to undervalue investment in relationships. And if we need to free up some time for that, I think that's a tremendous investment. So engagement with content, scaffolds, real world connections, active inquiry, feedback and assessment, and relationships. And if we're doing things other than that, that do not close instructional gaps, again, we have to ask ourselves why. So what can we do to identify and eliminate any work that is taking up lots of teachers' time and not really producing much impact. You know, I see a lot of promising things happening with websites, educational websites and apps and learning management systems that take on a lot of the unproductive busy work like grading math homework, right? Most teachers don't really grade all of their students' practice problems in math. We have different ways of checking for understanding because it's so tedious, it's so time consuming, it's such a slow way of giving students feedback compared to a website where students can answer a practice problem and then immediately get feedback and get some additional instruction if they need it. And just the proliferation of websites that help students with math has really proven that there's something real here, that math websites are better at teaching math in some respects than people are when it comes to providing instant feedback. Another big time waster that I'm seeing an epidemic of as we shift to online and hybrid forms of instruction is simply reinventing the wheel and treating each classroom as a unique workshop, a unique stage where unique performances and productions have to come together under the teacher's guidance. You know, really, students are the same everywhere, right? I think there's not much controversy around the idea that, what students have in common is much greater than what's different between students in one classroom and another. And we have standards for a reason. We have standards at the state and national level to help us align. And those standards make it possible to avoid duplicating effort simply by sharing resources. We can share resources and materials at the team level, at the school level, at the district level, and even across the profession. And there are lots of ways that we do that, you know, to the point that I feel silly even having to mention this, except that it is such a norm in our profession that you have to make your own stuff, you have to be original. I think we've got to really address that head on and give people permission not to reinvent the wheel and not to duplicate effort just because they have their own classroom. And then finally, producing documents for the sake of documents. I think we've got to be really careful about demanding things like written lesson plans. If they don't solve a specific problem for students, if they don't close an instructional gap, then we've got to be really careful about putting more on teachers' plates. So let's talk about originality a little bit more. I think this is a big time waster and a big kind of mindset trap for many teachers as well as many administrators who believe, you know, in reusing things, believe in getting, you know, curating the best resources that are out there, but also have this idea that has kind of persisted in the profession that if you're not making up your own stuff, then you're not a real teacher. If you're not really inventing and performing and being the sage on the stage, then you're not really being a real teacher. I think we've got to confront that misconception directly and say, you know what, just because it is your classroom and you want to make materials and resources your own, it doesn't mean you have to make them from scratch. Think of your role as a teacher as being one of curating and customizing and scaffolding and helping resources that you curate meet your students' needs, but it doesn't have to be a unique, original performance, right? We're not putting on a monologue, a one-person show every day in every classroom. We need to act like a profession and bring our students the best rather than try to create everything from scratch. So a couple of questions you can pose to your teachers in feedback conversations or get them thinking about if you see people burning themselves out trying to be original about everything, you know, get them to ask themselves, how can I curate or adapt existing resources rather than start from scratch? Or how can I team up with other teachers, either within the school or across the district or even online with people around the world, to get the best possible quality with the minimal possible effort? You know, there are efforts like Engage New York, where everything is available online. There are, I think our kids are using Great Minds, a curriculum that has a lot of teaching that has been done and recorded and put into high quality presentations so that teachers don't have to film their own lessons for their remote learners. You know, we've got to take advantage of those resources that are out there so that what teachers are adding is uniquely me, you know, uniquely their own style, their own relationship with students, and providing scaffolds to meet the needs of their students. We need to get rid of this originality expectation that's lurking beneath the surface. Second, some questions for you as a school leader. if we're having a meeting, if we're having some sort of discussion, you know, could we have that discussion in Google Docs? Could we do a survey? Could we do something other than taking up people's time with things that could be done in a more efficient format? Could we collect information in a more efficient way? You know, and what we're seeing teachers do right now with Google Classroom or other learning management systems, we can do those same things as leaders and not demand so much of people's time in terms of paperwork that they're doing or meetings that they're having to have. You know, this meeting could have been an email is now a universal realization that we have some big opportunities there to waste less time in meetings. And then finally, can I stop collecting information that I'm not going to actually use? If you can take an expectation like that off of teachers' plates, stop requiring lesson plans, stop requiring them to compile and turn in things just for you, this is the time to do it, my friend. For yourself as a school leader, can you find ways to stop making things from scratch, stop trying to be original all the time, and start reusing things? You know, if somebody asks a question today and somebody else asked it last week and you already have your answer saved, copy and paste that puppy. You know, reuse your writing if it's appropriate for the situation. We can share across schools. If you have a scheduling template for your grade band, you know, you have special classes or recess schedule, you know, share those documents, share those templates, and people can, you know, adjust the specifics without having to start completely from scratch. And then the last point I have on here is advocacy. You know, if your supervisor is asking you to do something or there's some sort of mandate, you know, maybe you can get a waiver from that. Maybe you can get permission to say, you know what, this is not the year to worry about that. We're just going to skip it and we'll come back to it in the future, perhaps. For district leaders, third, I want to pose some suggestions to district leaders for streamlining the work of the educators that you supervise. For compliance documents, I know often what district leaders are passing on to school leaders and teachers gets passed on to them from the feds, from the state, you know, from other policymakers and stakeholders who control money and need you to do certain things to get that money. A great way to make yourself a hero to your school administrators is to say, you know what, this plan is required. Every school has to have one, but I've done 90% of it for you. It's going to be the same across the district, and you just have to type in a few things to customize it for your school. Get it to me by Friday. Sound good? Okay. I love it when I see district leaders putting forth the extra effort. Instead of saying, okay, here's an email from the state, please take care of this yourself. What if you as a district leader sit down, do 90% of that work yourself, and say, here's my draft for you, save a copy for yourself, customize it, and send it in. If you have planned a meeting to talk about that document, could that meeting, of course, be an email instead of a Zoom meeting or a face-to-face meeting or whatever? And if it's not a mandate from the state or the feds or some other external party, if it's just something that you need to get yourself clear on so that you're aware of what's going on in schools, could it just be a phone call? Could you pick up the phone and say, hey, tell me about what you're doing for literacy intervention this year? And rather than require every school to submit a literacy intervention plan, talk with your leaders and figure out what they're doing, have that conversation, and then decide if you need to do something further, rather than just going straight to everybody needs to turn in a plan on this. So Pareto optimization, again, is the 80-20 idea. If we can find the 20% of efforts that are producing 80% of our results, we can eliminate much of the remaining 80% without sacrificing those results. That's the first big concept in today's episode. The second big concept, again, comes from Nobel laureate Herbert Simon. And Herbert Simon's research started in the 1940s and continued for much of the rest of the 20th century into organizational decision making. He was a big theorist around decision making and organizational improvement and how bureaucracies work, how large organizations make decisions. And again, this was a lot of the reading. I burned out an entire laser printer printing Herbert Simon articles and related literature in that field of organizational decision making. But he introduced this concept of satisficing, which is not probably a word that you use on a regular basis. It's a portmanteau of satisfy and suffice. And basically, it's the idea that good enough is good enough. And it's an idea that stands in contrast to the idea of perfectionism. And we would all say that perfectionism is unhealthy, right? We know that there are some places where we want to be very, very careful. It's probably okay to be a perfectionist about your resume. If there's a very, very high stakes situation where you really do have to be the best, it's okay to be a perfectionist and put the effort in to be your very best if you're in that kind of competitive context. But most of life isn't like that. Most of life, we do not have to have the very, very, very best. We do not have to optimize. So we still have the option, but most of the time we are going to want to satisfice. And there's a quote from Simon that I think helps us see the relationship between them. He says, "Decision makers can satisfice either by finding optimum solutions for a simplified world or by finding satisfactory solutions for a more realistic world. Neither approach dominates the other. Both have continued to coexist in the world of management science." And I think we can see this in schools, right? There are times when, you know, if you're applying for a competitive grant and you're going to bring a lot of money into your school, maybe you want to put in the extra work and be a perfectionist about that grant. If you have to fill out a form for compliance purposes, only one person's going to read it and nobody's really going to care about it, that is a great place to not be a perfectionist and to instead satisfice and say, you know what, good enough is good enough. And good enough is defined by some sort of criteria, right? We're not just saying, well, I'm going to be half perfectionist and that's going to be good enough. No, there's a usually a fixed standard for different types of work that we may have to do that tells us what is good enough. And it's wasteful to go beyond that, right? You know, when you pay your taxes, you are satisficing. You are not paying the maximum amount of taxes you possibly could. You might hire an accountant if you need help optimizing for paying as little taxes as possible, but basically we're going to meet the criteria, right? We're going to dot our T's and cross our I's and not worry about it too much beyond that. Think about the way that a lot of guys shop. I tend to shop this way. Like if I need a pair of shorts, I'm going to pick a store. I'm going to run into that store. I'm going to pick a pair of shorts. I'm going to say, okay, these look fine, and I'm going to get out of there. I am not going to spend an hour picking out a pair of shorts. I'm going to spend like maybe 2 minutes and I'm going to find something that meets the criteria, and that's going to be it. So we have got to look for ways to help teachers satisfice where they may currently be optimizing and being a perfectionist when there's really not a lot of value in doing that. One area where this can become an issue with online learning is when we have to pick the very best resource for a particular purpose. And I'm going to pick on math practice websites here because, you know, these are a great innovation. It's fabulous that we have so many math practice websites, but there's a temptation for teachers to be perfectionists and to optimize for the very best website for every particular skill or every particular activity. So one day they might say, okay, watch this in BrainPop. And another day they might say, take this quiz in Kahoot. And another time they might say, well, this explanation is really good on Khan Academy, or I really want you to get some practice in IXL. You know, we have all these different options. And one way that we can optimize in a way that's not healthy, in a way that's kind of perfectionistic and too stressful, is to use more resources than we need to. When instead, we could satisfice by picking one or maybe two of these and saying, you know what, this is what we are going to use. We're going to use MobiMax or, you know, whatever website you choose as a school. Whatever's available in there is probably good enough or pretty close. Maybe by adding a second website for practicing math, we could get almost all of the remaining benefit that we're not getting with that first website. But there's going to be a sharply diminishing return and a sharply increasing level of complexity and hassle and time wasted when we add more and more and more websites and logins. You know, we have to have a login for every single kid. So the more logins we have per student, the more tech issues that we're going to have, and the more emails that's going to generate for parents, and the more emails that's going to generate for the tech staff and the administration. So the complexity here is largely wasted. And we can probably get that 80% of the benefit by using only 20% of the websites that we may currently be using. So look for ways to empower your teachers to say, you know what, we're doing too much of this. We have too many options. We're trying to be a perfectionist about every single thing. Let's just use the one or two things that are going to give us the biggest payoff for our efforts. So a couple of takeaways when it comes to satisficing and the Pareto principle. You know, the big idea here is let's do less, but better. Let's free up people's time to do what really matters and take some of those time wasters off of the plate. And we've really got to find the 20% of efforts that produce 80% of our results. We've got to know what results we're here to create in the first place. So again, I'll refer you to our last episode, number 74 of the Instructional Leadership Show, where we talked about instructional gaps and zooming in on how we close those gaps for our students. And I'll also refer you to the 6 essential elements of engaging online instruction that we talked about earlier in this episode, and we'll have more on that for you soon. We have talked about satisficing and having a fixed criterion. You know, we have a standard of quality and excellence that we're striving for, but we're not being perfectionists. We're not saying, you know, this is just going to be the best email response that I could possibly write. No, we're going to reuse, we're going to recycle, we're going to be good enough, but not be perfectionists because we simply don't have time. When it comes to originality, I think we've got to get away from the sage on the stage mindset that every lesson every day is a performance and the teacher has to build it from scratch and do this kind of, wowing the audience of students. You know, there's so much that's already been created. We can curate, we can avoid reinventing the wheel and free up a ton of time so that we can focus on what our students really need from us when it comes to our attention and our time. So let me know what you think about that. Shoot me an email anytime at justin@principalcenter.com. I also wanted to let you know about a new resource that we have for you, 15 questions for feedback on virtual teaching. And you can get that at principalcenter.com/virtual-pdf. principalcenter.com/virtual-pdf. And what you'll find there is that in addition to our regular 10 questions for evidence-based feedback on teaching without triggering resistance, you know, those classic questions that are on the back of our note cards that you can use to get teachers talking about their thinking and talking about their practice. You know, if you're not able to get into classrooms or see a lesson directly, maybe you have different ways of doing that. If you're not able to see that lesson directly, though, I've got 15 questions in this new resource that will direct you to 5 alternate sources of evidence, including teacher-created resources, teacher-curated resources, student work, and more. So you can download that at principalcenter.com/virtual-pdf. That is it for episode 75 of the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm Justin Bader, and I will see you next time. Thanks so much for tuning in.